Today is April 14th. We have a guest with us today. We have Roman Hagelstein from Germany, and he is a fellow super forecaster and also started about the same time as the rest of us. And as I mentioned, he is living in Germany. He is an economist. First, we'll go ahead and introduce everybody. So my name is Scott.
I'm Roman.
I'm Robert.
My name is Atif.
First of all, what did you study?
I studied business, actually, but then I did my PhD in development economics, where I studied the Algerian Civil War. A bit unusual, but since civil wars are a big impediment to development, that's the reason why I turned to studying them. I studied the logic of violence and the spread of violence.
Before you were studying Algeria, you had lived in several different countries.
As a child, I lived in Germany and in France, and I graduated from high school back in Germany and then spent a year in Spain.
Do you think that's had much of an effect on the way you view the world?
Yes, certainly. First off, I speak many more languages, which made me more interested in the world, and which also made me soak up more perspectives on the world from media in different countries.
One thing that you had mentioned was that when you first became a super forecaster, you thought part of it is that you did get some questions correct, that's clear, but that also with your economic background, you're able to do some arbitrage. So you're able to basically know how a market works, how to play a market to maximize that.
Yes, I bought low and sold high.
Is that what you're supposed to do?
Wait, can you explain that to me again? Just slow it down.
That's how I became good at the market, actually becoming a market maker, the house in the casino, which made me end up doing pretty well at the end of the year.
In order to know if something is low or high, you have to have a sense of what it's worth, right? That involves the forecasting.
Yeah, but independently of the question, there was always a bid price and an asking price and a spread between them. And what I often did was just plugging in the best bid and the best offer and then wait until it gets taken up. And as soon as it gets taken up, what I did is put the shares back on the market and wait until somebody takes me up on the other side.
Oh, yeah. Your market was structured differently than ours.
Yes.
In your market, you had to match buyer and seller.
That's true.
Yeah, we were working in a market that wasn't that way.
Ours was much more fluid.
Of course, you had to keep paying attention to whether the spread was within a range that's plausible. Otherwise, you would get wiped out or stuck right with shares that you didn't want. So that was the being good at forecasting part. But you could also earn money by just not knowing very much about it. They later changed it, actually, because of that, probably.
You broke the market.
Yeah, we had the bad luck that they were trying different methods to see what was going to be most successful. And Atif, Robert, and I were all in the same market, and we unfortunately didn't have this option. Now that we're not in market anymore, how do you go about trying to forecast when you don't have this technical advantage?
The most helpful things in forecasting for me are the comments by the other super forecasters that are on the platform. So as long as I have these, I know at least how to anchor my forecast, and I don't very often stray away from the super forecaster consensus, except a few times where I really think that I have better information by way of, for instance, being German and having another perspective on it than most super forecasters who are based in the United States. Or other things where I know a bit about, which is, for instance, conflict, where I studied my PhD.
Do you think, being German, that it's easier or harder to forecast a German thing like the German election coming up?
I have a story about that to tell, which is about the last German election when Mrs. Merkel got reelected. Most of the German polls were giving her about 80% at that time. But the market was consistently giving her 97-98% or so. And I said, no way, how could it be so different from the polls? But still, I went in and I made a lot of money in that market and on that one by just acting as a market maker between 95% and 98%. And in the end, the market was right by extremizing a lot from the polls, which in the end surprised me.
I tried that with Hillary. It didn't work.
It often works, not always, apparently.
Right.
Is there anything that you learned from... First of all, did you forecast on the U.S. presidential election?
Yes, I did.
A lot of us didn't do so well on that one, although only very few people actually put her at 100% or 99%. So we could all say we were just on the wrong side of maybe, but we were extremely on the wrong side of maybe often. I mean, I understand what you're saying, that extremizing normally is working most of the time. If you were to have to reforecast that election, and obviously you have hindsight bias and you know that she lost, but if you could take that out and just said, knowing the things we know today, with the exception that she lost, how would you go about forecasting it now?
I would probably still be extremizing a little bit from the polls, just I would have done from the experience I got from the Merkel election 4 years ago. So probably a bit more wrong than the consensus still, if I just absolutely didn't know what to do. Because I would think from the outsider's perspective, more or less, that these polls, especially in the US, from what I could read, were pretty accurate at the last few US elections, especially the poll aggregators like 538. And I would have put my trusts mostly in these.
Can you actually talk a little bit about extremizing and explain to listeners what that is and why we think it's useful?
Yes, extremizing is going a bit into to the side of maybe in which a question already is. That is, if the consensus of the polls is about 80% or so, you might say 85%, just to be a bit bolder than the consensus. And the background about this is that there might be some mean reversion in the consensus.
Consensus is more likely to be towards 50%. They found actually in studies that if you take our consensus and extremize it a little bit, then it does even better than our consensus, right?
Actually, they found a kind of strange thing. They found that with the supers, they didn't need to extremize us very much, that we were essentially self-extremizing.
Right. And when I learned that, I self-extremized a little bit more,
exactly.
Too.
Did you really?
Yeah. I usually smear a little bit more times towards confident. Yeah.
I worry about that with the forecast. Like, I think that there's a certain amount of bias score chasing that can lead people to over-extremize.
I mean, isn't that the goal? If we chase Breyer score, aren't we being more accurate?
No.
Isn't that like accuracy chasing?
No, because there's an approach to probability that, you know, sometimes when we're talking about it, we'll say something like, you know, if you simulated the world 100 times. That's kind of how we're thinking about it. That's kind of how I think about it.
Like doing Monte Carlo simulations.
Yeah, it's not deterministic. There's a certain amount of randomness. Most of the time, you're going to get this outcome. Sometimes you're going to get this outcome. When you're forecasting, because your bias score essentially depends on how close you were to yes or no, 0, 100, there's a tendency, if it's close, to go very close to 0 or to go very high to 100 because you get a better bias score at the end. Assume it resolves at 0, 100. But that omits the, I'm simulating the universe 100 times, right? But the idea is, over 100 questions, there will be enough of them that look like they're 80 and end up being 0, which Hillary election is one of them, that you're kind of rewarded for sticking close to what you think the actual probability is, independent of how you think it's going to resolve. But I don't feel like we act like that. I feel like there are a couple of questions I can think of where I think the actual probability is probably 15, 20%. So it's unlikely, but people have pushed it down to 5%, I think just because, oh, it's unlikely, it's probably going to resolve at 0, and my score will be better if it resolves at 0. And I think there's a certain amount of strategizing involved.
I'm not trying to do that. I know what you're saying. You're saying essentially if there's a 99% probability of something, that means 99 times out of 100, I'll benefit by saying there was 100% probability.
Yes.
And that's not really accurate to do it that way. But I don't try to do that. I just think that if I think there's a 98% chance of something, that probably it's more like 99.
There was a test that we actually took. All of us took a test on how accurate we are in
calibration.
Yeah, calibration. Calibration is basically how accurate we are at knowing when we know something. And I give the example that if somebody asks me who's the president of Romania, I can tell you with 100% certainty because I know him. If I ask you, you know, who's the president of America, I know him 100%. No question. I don't know Trump, but I know him, who he is. So 100%, I know him. If you ask me, you know, who's the one of Azerbaijan, I might be like, wow, was that? And then I might get to sort of 55% or whatever. And so our ability to know when we truly know something is important. And super forecasters tend to calibrate better than most people. So when we don't know something, we're more likely to say, yeah, we really are lost.
Right. Because we're paranoid of Dunning-Kruger.
Yeah. Being idiots.
Well, there's also a metacognition. I'm actually thinking about how am I systematically wrong and trying to correct for it in some way.
Yeah.
But there's also a problem, and this is, I think, for all people. So this podcast is not only listened to by super forecasters, and this is, and you also get into gambling fallacies or bettors fallacies. So if you have three or four wins in a row, then you start getting more confident and think, I had to extremize more because, wow, I think I'm really pretty good. And I've had the opposite case. So after the election of Trump, I really had, you know, serious doubts. Like, if I got this one so wrong and this is one that I really followed, should I start doing the opposite of extremizing? You know, like if I'm thinking it's 80, should I be going to 75 or 70? Or should I just simply be more diligent in my research, which is probably the better answer, or look more at more outside sources? Our emotions do get into it.
I have a question, Roman. You have lived in a couple of places, a few places. You've spoken with people in a variety of places about forecasting. I don't know a lot about Germany. In the United States, we have a lot of German words that we've incorporated. And a lot of them express interesting, realistic, complex, and sometimes pessimistic emotions. Like Weltschmerz is one, I guess Schadenfreude is another that we love, but they're interesting words. Is there something in German culture that you think impacts your forecasting in a way that's different from forecasters in other countries?
Yeah, I think German business culture is much less emotional than in many other countries, right? We begin our meetings at exactly the time that they are allocated, and we also finish them at exactly this time. And unbeknownst to many, Germans actually work the least hours every year, but they do so very efficiently, and also because a lot of them work part-time. And
so does that translate into a philosophical approach to forecasting that differs from what you've seen in other people? So, for example, I do think the United States tends to be a very optimistic country, like culturally optimistic country. In fact, I remember I had a guy who used to cut my hair, a Chinese guy, who used to say we were like kids. He's like, you guys are so, you're naive like children. But I do think the United States has a certain level of optimism that I think could translate into the way I forecast stuff. Like, I may look at something and be like, yeah, you know, especially when you look at it in the context of our political system, where I just have this assumption that we have a lot of veto points, and I don't think things are going to change that much just because America generally gets by and we have a system that's pretty good at actually preventing any kind of sharp turns or stark changes in what happens. And I think part of that is, I think a lot of that is objective, but I do think part of that might be cultural.
Yeah, the German mindset, if I may call it that way, because there are really many different Germanys if you go from Hamburg in the north to Bavaria in the south, it's very rules-based as opposed to what you were describing about the American culture. And this has some advantages, but other disadvantages too. For instance, that it encourages groupthink to just not stray too far away from what the rules are.
I was amazed when I spent time in Germany that people didn't jaywalk. Then I later went to Berlin and discovered that in Berlin, people not only jaywalk, but they write things on the walls and they believe this is a political right to do so. Are people from Berlin different in that way because of their political history?
Certainly.
Less likely to follow rules?
Yeah, Berlin is famous in Germany for being the city of the draft dodgers, basically.
Is that a positive or a negative?
Yeah, back in the 80s, you had to go to the military in every single Western German country, except in West Berlin, where if you just fled for a few years from North Rhine-Westphalia to West Berlin and just came back when you were 26, then you didn't have to do the military service at all.
Was this a method to make people in basically West Berlin happy and to sort of give the finger to the East Berliners?
I don't know, but another aspect of it was that Berlin was super heavily subsidized, so they didn't really need to do well in economic terms or administrative terms. They just got the money handed to them all the time, so that encouraged a little sloppiness as opposed to the very heavily audited other parts of West Germany. And the East, of course, was kind of a more totalitarian state, which meant that both the West and the East had some rules-based controls that West Berlin at least didn't have. But the creative culture that's been growing in Berlin for the past 20 years has mostly been growing in the eastern part of former Berlin because rents were much cheaper. So it might have been a combination of that unique thing with also being the nightclub capital of Europe in the early 90s and the cheap rents.
One question I was curious about is, if you're coming from a country that basically follows rules quite well, is it more difficult for you to try to forecast in highly chaotic? I mean, obviously, it's difficult for everybody to forecast in highly chaotic situations, but you find it more difficult for you to get your mind around highly chaotic situations than somebody who comes from maybe a society that's not so structured.
I personally am reasonably chaotic for a German, so that's one aspect.
What does that mean?
You might have seen some of these pictures. What does chaos mean to a German? There are some, if you Google it, you can find them, and it's maybe three hairpins arranged in a row, and one of the three is arranged reversed, so that's chaos.
So speaking of chaos, you studied civil wars.
That's right. I was interested while studying in development economics, and civil war is maybe the hardest impediment to sustained development because especially these asymmetric wars in the developing world, they tend to last 10, 20 years, so a very long time. When people start the wars, they don't anticipate that it's going to sustainably harm the development of their country for the next 20 years. I was interested first in the question, why do these wars start? And then found that another very interesting question to answer is, why do they last so long? What makes the dynamic of violence take over? And why do people not settle their scores quickly, but make it go on and on a local micro level?
What did you conclude?
I concluded that the only factor that really explains violence today in a war is violence in the past, in the same area.
So it's just a habit?
Yeah, it's contagion, basically, and it's revenge dynamics, I would say. I mean, I tested some variables at a local level, like economics, how rich was the province or the area, and population density and all this. They did have some influence in the model, but much less than whether the same area had also had a violent event in the past. Now, there are, of course, a lot of possibilities that this research may not be 100% complete, because when you study local level civil war dynamics, you always have a lot of ecological fallacy. GDP, for instance, was measured at a province level, which is far too rough as a proxy for the local level violence, which I was studying. The one factor that really trumped everything else in the analysis was whether there was violence the last year. So the elasticity was about 0.4, 0.5. So if in 1 year you had violence somewhere, then in the same area you would have 50% or more probability to have violence in the same area, at least in the war I studied.
Tit for tat, basically.
Yes.
We saw that in U.S. politics, in the coverage of the filibuster, the nuclear option for the filibuster, where a lot of the back and forth, sure, some of it was political posturing, but a lot of it really seemed to be people saying, well, we did this because you did this. Oh, and we changed that rule because you guys did this. And oh, we changed that rule because you did this. The FARC peace deal, one of the reasons, at least that I read, for people rejecting the vote was they just felt like these guys hadn't been punished enough. They wanted an apology. They wanted contrition. They didn't just want to do the sort of rational thing and move on past this very violent, self-defeating encounter. When people are locked in these kinds of, or when groups are locked in that kind of tit-for-tat cycle of violence, how do they get out?
It's really hard to get out of the spiral. And I have really two theories, which I didn't test thoroughly, and my research is dating 2010, so maybe it's gone on from then. I'm not in the current literature, but the two ones I have is the first that the generation just grows out of the war. There's a new youth generation that has nothing to do with the disputes of their parents. So after 20 years, these wars resolve somehow. And the other one in the...
People don't resolve the war. They just eventually die.
They die off.
Yeah. That's one possibility. And it sure is a combination of many factors in the end that makes wars more die down than be resolved by decisive victory of one party. And the other one is the decisive victory of one party factor, where the losing party is decimated so much that they just can't continue fighting on. They are very often compelled to fight on well beyond the point at which they really lost, actually. And the reason for that is that you can't just surrender, because if you would, you would spend the remainder of your days tortured or in prison. So being at least free for a few more years is preferable to that.
There's no off ramp in a civil war.
I actually had a talk at the end of the year with somebody who is representative of a government from a country currently in civil war. And he was basically asking, why do the people not just come back? Because one of his comments was that surely governments take care of their people. So if you are somebody who had left this war zone and came back, you should be fine. But in fact, many of the people who have left the war zone and gone to other countries are terrified of coming back, because exactly what you were saying, that they're assuming that they will end up in jail, they will end up tortured. And so even though if a lot of refugees would come back to a place and say like, yeah, okay, the government gives us somehow amnesty, we could move on, they don't have the belief that the government would give them amnesty, essentially.
So that's how civil wars continue beyond the point where the losing side has lost, and then the security forces of the winning side manage to clean it up after a few years. That's how it ends. It's very unglorious, but actually, it's hard to tell whether in a civil war the right or the less evil side would win, because it's very often the most violent side that wins. There's a saying that is, war does not decide who is right, war only decides who is left.
I have a development question about the civil war. It makes total sense to me that countries don't develop well while there's an actual ongoing conflict. But I wonder, after the Civil War, is it in a way an advantage if the country has been, infrastructure and so on, has been torn down? I know that sometimes in development, it's harder to develop if you're using antiquated or trying to maintain old infrastructure than if you're starting from scratch. Civil War countries rebound after it's over at all?
Yeah, actually, I think there are two main points to consider in this. And the first one is that if you just come out of a civil war, you have a much higher chance of getting into another civil war soon. Coming out of a civil war is a variable that's predicting going into a civil war very well. It's sad, but that's the way it is. And the other one is, yeah, you might have quicker recoveries after civil wars just to grow faster from the lower basis that you just spent 20 years growing under your potential. But on the other hand, war destroys a lot of human and physical capital, especially if refugees are gone and don't come back. More specifically, if you take the case of Algeria, the war that I studied, the economy recovered after the war, and it did not relapse in the Arab Spring, curiously enough, while all the neighbors like Tunisia and Libya were having their conflicts. The Algerian government had learned from the prior civil wars. Now there are barricades everywhere, checkpoints, everybody is checked all the time. And so there were no protests during the Arab Spring in Algeria, curiously enough, because of the security forces watching everybody. But they could only afford this recovery because the government finances looked much, much better than they had looked in the late 90s when oil prices were very, very low.
One thing that I was just thinking about is the difference between civil war and, I don't know if you want to say all-out war, but like with World War II, both Germany and Japan were pretty well decimated, and both I would say, recovered extraordinarily well. And part of it, I think, is the culture of both countries. Both countries have a characteristic of being not so much self-centered, but working as a group, working for the community, working as a nation, not working as a group of random individuals. There's a lot of different, I mean, they also did get support, but I think there's a lot of things they did themselves to become the countries they are today. But I'm curious how, you know, how you view this, because clearly they were horribly damaging wars for Germany and Japan, but that they managed to, you know, essentially really, really rebound, I think, economically and socially is amazing. And why did it work for them and not for everybody else?
Yes, first of all, the Second World War was a transnational war, for which I'm not much of an expert. Transnational wars are often much shorter than civil wars, especially in developing countries. Germany has had its share of civil wars in the 15th and 16th century, all those, and the 30 Years' War and the peasant uprising.
Do those count as civil wars? I mean, they weren't really the same state at that point.
Yes, of course. But the territories that were in Germany had a lot of civil wars, and you could count them as such. Anyway, the German recovery after the Second World War is really such a widely told story because it's so unusual and so unlikely, perhaps. On the other hand, Germany already was in the position to succeed even before the Second World War. All the seeds of a successful top 20 economy in the world were planted. And then came the East-West conflict, in which Germany was at the front line, where the country was on one hand propped up by both the Soviets and Western allies. And on the other hand, what the East-West conflict solved was the long-standing conflict between Germany and France, because it made these two countries allies between the bigger threat.
Thank you for the segment, Roman.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.